From Birds Canada, this is The Warblers. This is The Wake Up Call, a special podcast series from The Warblers by Birds Canada. I'm Andrea Gress. Join me as I speak with experts about our most threatened bird species, why these species are at risk, and what conservation actions are being taken. And finally, what we can all do to help. Welcome back to the Warblers podcast by Birds Canada. This is another wake-up call episode where we like to feature a threatened species in Canada. So in the past, we've featured birds like marbled murrelet and bicknose thrush. And of course, you know the piping plover because I never stop talking about them. And today we've got another really cool bird, kind of not unlike a piping plover. I think you'll really like it. And I'm curious if folks have heard of it before. It is the red knot. We've got Amy McDonald from British Columbia. She's based out of Vancouver. She's our MODIS coordinator and shorebird ecologist for Birds Canada out that way. How's it going, Amy?
It's going well, Andrea. Thanks for having me on.
I hear you're a big, big fan of the red knots.
I am. You mentioned that you don't stop talking about piping plovers. Well, I am kind of the same way about red knots. They're just so cool.
I'm here for it. You know, weird bird obsession. It's a fun thing. So tell me, what is a red knot?
So red knots are a type of shorebird, like the piping plover, but they're not a plover. They're in the sandpiper group. So they're in the genus Calidris. And some of the other members of that group that people might be familiar with are like semi-palmated sandpipers or western sandpipers or Dunlin. So the sandpipers, they have generally pretty long legs and pretty long bills. And red knots are a medium-sized shorebird. They're about the same size as a robin. And they also have a rusty red breast in breeding plumage. But other than that, they look pretty different from robins. In breeding plumage, they, in addition to their rusty red breast and face, their back and their wings and the top of their head is kind of a speckled gray color. They're really beautiful. And then in non-breeding plumage, they're kind of more of a uniform gray and some whitish on the breast. So they don't have that striking red color in the non-breeding plumage. And then the juvenile birds look kind of similar to the adults in non-breeding plumage, except on their gray feathers, they have these really distinct white and black edging to the feathers that almost makes them look a bit scaly. It's quite striking.
Yeah. And will you typically see them in smaller numbers, or are they in larger flocks?
It can be either. Often, it depends when you're seeing them. So on migration, they're often in large flocks, although sometimes you might get a handful of red knots mixed in with the flock of a different species of shorebird. But sometimes you'll see them in big flocks of several thousand birds, even in one location at, say, a migration stopover site. Whereas up in the breeding grounds, they're much more sparsely distributed.
It must be just delightful to see a large flock come through.
Yeah, it's really spectacular. I have to say that it's one of my favorite noises when you hear a flock of shorebirds all kind of rush past you in flight, and they're all flying in unison like that. There's just this whoosh of their wings as they go by, and it's really special.
That sounds beautiful. Do they do the thing that piping plovers do where when they're on the wintering grounds, they're like super chill with each other, but when they're breeding, they get really competitive and kind of distant?
Probably. I honestly have to admit, I'm not sure. I've never seen red knots on the breeding grounds because they breed up in the Arctic. And I haven't been there yet. I've mainly worked with red knots on migration, at which point they are really mixing in with each other in big flocks, but there's still a little bit of competition there. It's pretty fun to watch them feeding when they're on migration stopover. And so they'll be in a big tight flock on the mud flats, probing and pecking at the mud, looking for invertebrates. And sometimes one bird will kind of run over to another one and just like bump into it and kind of push it out of the way or something, it seems like.
Love it. Just like humans. So You said they nest in the high Arctic. What are we talking about?
Well, there's actually 6 different subspecies of red knots in the world, and they are circumpolar breeders, so they breed all around the Arctic, in Canada, in Russia, in Alaska. But we have three of those subspecies here in the Western Hemisphere. So you've got the Atlantica subspecies, which breeds in the high Arctic, so like up on Ellesmere Island, for example, as well as in Greenland and Svalbard. But they spend the non-breeding season in Europe and the Mediterranean. So they're only in the Western Hemisphere in the breeding season. And then you've got the Roeselare subspecies that breeds in northwestern Alaska and Wrangel Island, which is in Russia, I believe. And then they spend the non-breeding season from like Southern California down through Central America. And then the Rufa subspecies breeds also in the Arctic in Canada, but generally a bit lower latitudes than the Icelandica subspecies, which is in the high Arctic. Although where that line, if there is one, is not particularly well known. We don't exactly know where one subspecies breeding range ends and the other one begins. There's probably overlap there, but we don't really know. So the Rufa subspecies breeds kind of in this central and eastern Arctic. And that's the subspecies that I've done most of the work I've done on. So probably what I'll talk about most today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got to be really, really hard to really know what's happening up on the breeding grounds when they're so, so remote and high up there. And where does the Rufus subspecies summer? Where do they migrate to?
Yeah, so the Rufa subspecies breeds in the Arctic, and then there are three different non-breeding groups that spend the North American winter in different areas. And so there are what in shorebird terms we could call short distance migrants, although it's still pretty far. They migrate down to the southeastern U.S. and the Gulf Coast and the Caribbean, so around Florida and through the Caribbean. And then there's another group that spends the non-breeding season in northern Brazil. And then there's a third group that are extreme long-distance migrants that migrate all the way down to the southern tip of South America, to Patagonia and Tierra del Fuego.
Wow.
Yes, that's about...
That's wild.
15,000 kilometers one way. So they do 30,000 kilometers a year migrating.
A year. Yeah. And you're talking about a bird that's the size of a robin. Unreal. So if folks in Canada wanted to see these birds, you know, it's not likely they're venturing up to the breeding grounds. Where would folks spot them? I'm guessing it's as they pass through.
Yes. The red knots pass through more southern parts of Canada on migration. You can see them in smaller numbers in the Bay of Fundy. They also do go through southern Ontario as well. And then fairly large numbers go through some of the prairie provinces as well, like the Chaplain Lake area in Saskatchewan. The area that I studied red knots is the southwestern James Bay coast, which is it's a fair trip to get up there too. It's not not necessarily quite as difficult to get to as the Arctic, but I acknowledge that it's not super easy to get to all the time. Those are a few places. The Mingan Archipelago is another important stopover site for red knots near the mouth of the St. Lawrence River in Quebec.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe where James Bay is?
Yeah, absolutely. So James Bay is the smaller bay that comes off the southeastern edge of Hudson Bay. So if you drive pretty much north from Toronto, up eastern Ontario, you'll get to James Bay, and some of the communities there are Moosonee and Moose Factory, and redknots stop in large numbers on their southbound migration along the southwestern coast of James Bay there.
Yeah, so that's not, you know, if you're looking for just some quick bird tourism, that is not your spot. Chaplain Lake is a good recommendation, though, out in Saskatchewan. I like that one. So you were working up in James Bay with these birds. Could you tell me more about the studies you were doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was working as part of the larger James Bay Shorebird Project, which does a whole variety of shorebird research along the James Bay coast, because it's a really important stopover site for redknots, but also many other shorebird species. And I specifically, for my master's research, was looking at how many redknots are using James Bay as a stopover site, and how does the stopover site get used throughout the season in terms of when are the peaks of redknots there, how many adults are there versus juvenile birds are coming through there, and what is the rate of survival for redknots that are using James Bay as a stopover site.
And you mentioned that you might see large flocks of these birds. So how do you track, how do you know what's happening? How do you know how many numbers there are there?
There are a few different ways that you can estimate how many birds are using a particular site. There's certainly through counts, so count surveys, whether that's ground counts or aerial counts from, say, a helicopter. That's one way. The way I was doing it was actually through some models that use resightings of individual birds and the rate at which they're seen to estimate the numbers of birds at the site. So redknots are kind of a unique species in shorebird research in that a large proportion of the population has been marked with uniquely coded leg flags that can be read through a spotting scope. A little less than 10% of the birds that we would see in James Bay were marked with these leg flags. So that's quite a lot because they've been quite well studied in other parts of their range. And I could resight these individual birds, read the codes on their leg flag, and that way I would know which individual bird it was. And I could use some modeling techniques to estimate how long birds were staying in the area. And then that would inform how we know how many birds are using the area by feeding those individual resightings into the model and also feeding scan surveys we did to record the proportion of each flock that were marked with these leg flags.
This episode is sponsored by Birds and Beans. Honestly, this is my go-to coffee every morning. Birds and Beans was founded to help save migratory songbirds by roasting and selling only 100% Smithsonian certified bird-friendly beans. So if you drink coffee and want to help birds, check them out at birdsandbeans.ca. Free shipping in Canada for coffee orders over $45. Birds and Beans will even donate 10% from your coffee purchase if you order from birdsandbeans.ca/warblers or use the link in the episode description. Birds and Beans, a richer taste, a richer earth. Were there any individual birds that you were enamored by, or, you know, like a migration journey of an individual that you tracked that you'd like to share?
Yeah, absolutely. It was really kind of special getting to work in the James Bay area. It's an absolutely beautiful region, and the landscape is just spectacular, as are the numbers of birds that move through. And I was fortunate enough to get to go back for many years. I did my master's research for 2 summers, but I actually was up there in various capacities on the project for 6 summers, or at least parts of some summers. And that meant I was seeing the same birds year after year, and you'd kind of start to recognize certain leg flag codes, and it was like seeing a friend again in some ways. I was always happy to recognize a bird and know that it had survived its migration for another year. One bird in particular that I got really excited about was a bird that was banded in Argentina originally. So there's a famous red knot that was banded in Argentina in 1995, and its leg flag code is B95. So it's known as B95, and it was recited for many years in various places from southern Argentina to the Arctic. And it was seen for, I think, until it was at least known to be about 20 years old. So in that time, it had migrated the distance, more than the distance to the moon.
Wow.
Over the course of its lifetime. It's also known as Moonbird, and there's actually been a book written about it. So I was out one day reciting birds on the mudflats in James Bay when I saw a bird with an orange leg flag, and it was really faded and old looking, the flag. So I was like trying to read it through the spotting scope, and I couldn't quite make it out. And I was creeping closer and closer, trying to get close enough to read the flag, but not to scare the birds away. And I eventually did start to read the flag, and I saw that the first letter was B, and I was like, oh my goodness, could it be? Anyway, I ultimately did get close enough to read it. It was not B95. But it was B53, and I was like, that seems like the same string of flags. Could it be? And it was a pretty old-looking flag, so I was like, this seems like it's probably also a pretty old bird. And where we were in James Bay is fairly remote, so we don't have cell service or anything, so I had to send a message out by a satellite device and said, can you look up what bird this is and when it was banded? And my supervisor got back to me and said it was banded in 2001. So it wasn't as old as B95, but it was still, this was in 2018. So I think the bird was, I think it was banded as an adult. So I think the bird was at least 17 or 18 years old at that point, which is pretty long for a red knot, and pretty cool that it's been migrating back and forth between the Arctic and Argentina for all those years.
It's pretty impressive. Like, safe to say it was banded before you started studying birds, right?
Yeah, I started studying. I did my first shorebird involvement in about 2013.
Yeah, wow. And it was banded in 2001. Very, very cool. So how is the red knot population doing, dare I ask?
Well, unfortunately, I can't say that the red knot population is doing great. The red knots declined a lot in the late 90s and early 2000s. So particularly the really long distance migrant red knots that go all the way down to southern Argentina and Chile have declined by about 80% since the 1980s. And the period of steepest decline was in the early 2000s. And during that period, adult survival declined by almost 40%. So it was a really steep, dramatic decline then. And unfortunately, red knot populations haven't really recovered since then, although the rate of decline has leveled off somewhat. But there have also been some concerningly low counts during the northbound migration period within the last few years that we worry leaves the population susceptible to the impacts of, say, a particularly bad weather event or a year where breeding or part of migration doesn't go so well. Because those numbers are so low, they can be quite affected by that. Whereas in earlier years, when the population was higher, they might be able to withstand those sorts of fluctuations better.
Mm-hmm. I'd imagine they're dealing with some challenges on the breeding grounds with climate change. That has to be impacting nesting birds up there.
Yeah. Climate change is definitely a threat, both on the breeding grounds and in other parts of their annual cycle as well. On the breeding grounds, breeding is timed somewhat with the emergence of insects as things thaw out in the Arctic. And there was some research done on red knots in Europe, and that migrate from northern parts of Russia to parts of Africa that linked changes in climate to reduced survival.
Mm-hmm. And what other threats would they be facing? Like you said, there was a huge population decline there. Do you know what was behind that?
Yeah. So red knots are really interesting species because they migrate so far. They're dependent on various habitats and places that are quite far apart, and they migrate in these kind of big multi-day nonstop flights where they burn a lot of energy, and then they arrive at a stopover site and they spend the next couple of weeks feeding and building up fat reserves to fuel their next big flight. The birds will actually shrink their digestive organs in preparation for these flights because they're going to be flying for multiple days nonstop. So they're not necessarily going to be feeding during that time. So they'll reallocate that energy from the digestive tract to things like wing muscles. So it's really a interesting physiological adaptation to power this long distance migration.
Yeah, that is a deeply fun fact. The adaptations birds have. Oh, so many cool species.
One of the really, really important stopover sites for the Rufa subspecies of red knots is Delaware Bay on the U.S. East Coast. And when they arrive in Delaware Bay in the spring, that coincides with horseshoe crabs coming up on the beaches to spawn. And so red knots will feed voraciously on horseshoe crab eggs, which are rich in fat and great for fueling their migration onwards to the Arctic. And in the late 90s and early 2000s, over-harvesting of horseshoe crabs led to these, or was a big contributor at least, to these big declines in the red knot population because they didn't have enough food in Delaware Bay to build up those fat reserves that they needed to fuel their migration.
Yeah, for sure. That's a huge, huge issue. Something that, you know, I wouldn't have necessarily thought about the impact of our consumption on theirs. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really interesting situation, actually, because the horseshoe crabs, they're fished for bait, for the bait industry. And so a lot of that fishing for bait led to the over-harvesting. And the fishery did become more regulated after that happened, although the regulations do vary from state to state. So New Jersey banned the harvesting of female horseshoe crabs to protect that supply of eggs for red knots and other shorebirds to feed on. But there has been some potential of reopening some level of harvesting of female horseshoe crabs again. And then other states have different regulations regarding horseshoe crab harvesting too. So it's an ongoing threat for red knots. And then the really interesting part of it is that the bait fishery is not the only way that horseshoe crabs are harvested. Horseshoe crab blood actually has a component. There's an extract of it called limulus amebocyte lysate, or LAL, that is used in biomedical testing to test for bacterial endotoxin contamination in drugs and medical devices. So it's used in the biomedical industry to test for this contamination that can be life-threatening for people, but it's being taken from live animals. And so large numbers of horseshoe crabs are bled and then released back into the wild. But some amount of those horseshoe crabs may die. And it's, even if they don't die, it's certainly possible that their spawning output is affected by having their blood taken.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I didn't know I'd learn about crabs in this bird podcast.
Yes. Yes, there is a strong link between horseshoe crabs and red knots, and other shorebirds too, but red knots in particular. And yeah, horseshoe crabs are really an interesting animal. They've been around for 450 million years, and they have this really useful aspect to their blood, which is blue, interestingly enough. Mm. But we have to think about the demand on an ecological system in something like this, even though what we mm-hmm. are using it for is public health, which is certainly an important topic as well. The good news is that there is a synthetic alternative to this LAL compound, and it's called recombinant factor C. Now, I am no expert in this kind of biomedical field at all, so that's about all I know about it. But there is a synthetic alternative, and it's been starting to be used as an alternative to the product that's coming from horseshoe crabs. So that's good, although the industry has been slow to adopt the use of this synthetic alternative that doesn't rely on live wild animals.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing, I feel like crabs don't get a lot of sympathy. I mean, I think they're deeply fascinating and cool creatures, but I know not everybody feels that way. So there's probably not as large of a push to conserve their population. And then, of course, we get these trickle-down impacts on other species.
Yeah, definitely. It's a good example of the linkages in an ecosystem and in a species life history.
Mm-hmm. And are there other threats and challenges to red knots, given that, I mean, just that their migration's so huge? They've got these stopover sites with challenges. They're heading down to South America. There must be just a wide array of things. And I would suspect it'd be hard to track even what might be impacting the population in its whole range.
It definitely is challenging because their range is so large, because they rely on so many different sites. They pass through so many different countries. Conservation has to happen across many jurisdictions, which is always a challenge. But I think shorebird biologists and conservationists really collaborate well and work together for red knots and other declining shorebirds. Certainly beyond the threats associated with horseshoe crab harvesting, habitat loss due to coastal development and sea level rise is a threat to red knots, and disturbance on beaches where they need to rest and refuel for these big migrations, and their time there is limited because they need to get to the Arctic to breed in time. If they don't have that kind of quiet area to do so, if there's a lot of disturbance happening, that could also have negative effects.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned in the intro that you're the British Columbia MODIS coordinator for Birds Canada. Are they using MODIS to track red knots as well and just learn that much more about their migration?
Yes, MODIS has been used to track red knots for a variety of different projects. I haven't used MODIS myself to track red knots specifically, so lots of credit to all the other great biologists who are doing that work. Red knots have been tracked migrating from Delaware Bay up through North America using MODIS, and so this particular research was able to show that red knots that were able to refuel adequately in Delaware Bay were able to migrate faster than red knots who weren't able to build up as big fat reserves as the other birds. And then the ones that left Delaware Bay in better body condition were also migrating back south later, suggesting that they may have been more successful breeding. So that's one example of research from various biologists with Environment and Climate Change Canada, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and some environmental organizations in the States worked on that one. And red knots have been tracked using MODIS all the way south in Argentina and Chile as well. And then the other subspecies of red knots, the Rosellari subspecies on the West Coast, researchers are using MODIS to track them in northwestern Mexico.
Very cool. I'm sure we'll do a full big episode about MODIS at some point, but just for listeners who haven't heard this term before, MODIS is a really vast network of towers, essentially, that when we put a MODIS tag on a bird, if the bird flies close to the tower, it pings. And so as these birds make their long migrations, it pings various towers and we can track their journey pretty darn well these days, actually. It's a very impressive network with so much collaboration, and it's really quite cool. It's a cool project that you're working on with the MODIS stuff.
Yeah, it is a really neat example of the power of collaboration. You're exactly right in the way that you describe it. It's a international collaborative network that uses radio telemetry to track small flying animals, mostly birds, but also bats and even some insects. And the key that makes MODIS work is that the transmitters that you might deploy on animals are detectable not only on the MODIS stations that you set up, but also the other stations in the network that other researchers have set up, and vice versa. The stations that you set up may detect animals tagged by other researchers elsewhere. So it just increases the scale and the impact of the work we're able to do, because we can then track these animals at large distances, particularly smaller animals that might be too small to carry other tracking technologies like satellite tags.
Yeah, like they've tagged monarch butterflies, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, perfect example of an incredible migration, a very, very small species that we can track with these MODIS towers. Really, really cool. I do want to, you mentioned it a moment ago about the fat stores that these birds are building up as they migrate and they travel. I just wanted to emphasize for folks how big of a thing that is. If a bird isn't able to store up those fat stores and then they migrate and they arrive without, you know, that beefy, healthy body that they need to breed and continue on, they might not have a successful breeding season. And then they start that migration again without having been successful. And I would think that has a big impact on the population if we are just seeing less healthy birds, if their migration isn't going as well.
Yeah. And that is one area of research that we'd like to tease apart a little more, is the role of recruitment or juvenile survival in population trajectories compared to the rate of adult survival in population trajectories. So what impact is each of those things having, whether the adults survive or whether they're able to breed successfully? How is that influencing population declines and hopefully population recovery eventually?
Mm-hmm. And on that note, how are you feeling about population recovery? Are you feeling optimistic for the future of this species?
That's a tough question. I think that there are a lot of people who are working really hard for red knots, and they've been doing amazing work that really deserves recognition. Biologists in Argentina, Chile, Brazil, who've been studying and advocating for red knot conservation for years, and biologists and environmental groups in the US and Canada who've been working to protect Red Knot habitat and food supply. First Nations like Moose Cree First Nation, who have promoted and prioritized shorebird conservation in their traditional territories, the whole coastline along James Bay that's within the Moose Cree First Nation homeland is recognized as a key biodiversity area, in part because of the high numbers of shorebirds that it supports. So I think there are a lot of people who are working really hard for shorebird conservation and Red Knots in particular, and that there are some really positive steps being made. I really hope that this, the use of this synthetic alternative to horseshoe crab blood gets taken up more widely. And there have been some pieces of good news recently as well. In April, there were over 30,000 more acres designated as critical habitat under the Endangered Species Act in the U.S. for Red Knots. And the closure of 30 beaches in South Carolina to horseshoe crab harvest, so that during the spring migration season, so that birds have those crab eggs to feed on. So that's some good news. But I think the Red Knots are facing a lot of challenges and threats, and their populations are so much lower than they were, you know, a few decades ago. So it's not going to be easy to recover those populations, you know, even though there have been some wins in terms of protecting habitat and regulating horseshoe crab harvest. There are also some challenges there with potential increases of harvest or continued harvest of horseshoe crabs that threatens Red Knots. So I think it's possible, but it won't be easy. And I hope that we will get there. It would be a really sad world without Red Knots.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What could listeners do to help the species?
Yeah, I think that one thing that people can do is when they're out on beaches during migration season, making sure to reduce the disturbance on beaches and give birds the space that they need to rest and refuel. And I think that's probably similar to piping plovers.
Oh yeah, you're preaching to the choir.
Yeah, in this case, the Red Knots aren't necessarily breeding on those beaches, but they are really depending on those areas so they can make it on their next migration step. And then, you know, recognize that these habitats are really important for the birds and advocate for their protection. One other thing I'll recommend that isn't necessarily an action to help Red Knots, but I think if you're interested in learning more about Red Knots, there's a really wonderful book called The Narrow Edge, written by Deborah Kramer, that's all about Red Knots and their life history and the threats they face. And she's a wonderful writer who followed Red Knots throughout their journey to all these different places that they rely on, from Southern South America to the Arctic, and talk to biologists in each of these places working on studying Red Knots, and recorded the whole journey and wrote about it. So it's a really wonderful book that I'd recommend to people if they're interested to learn more.
Oh man, so interesting to learn about another threatened species here in Canada, the Red Knot. So listeners, go check out that book, The Narrow Edge, if you want to keep learning. Learning about these species and then getting excited about them and their conservation efforts and sharing that knowledge is a really, really good way to help birds. Thank you so much, Amy, for joining. It was fantastic having you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Andrea. It was great to be here.
Until next time, folks, get out and get birding. The Warblers is a podcast of Birds Canada. Our goal is to bring you the information you need to discover, enjoy, and protect birds. If you like what you hear, please subscribe, leave a review, and share this podcast with everyone you know. Birds Canada relies on the support of donors like you. Visit birdscanada.org/warblerspodcast to make a donation today. The Warblers is produced by Jody Allaire, Kate Dogleash, Chris Koo, and Andrea Gress, with music by Jose Mora and art by Alex Nickel. Until next time, keep birding.